Oh, I think we're live.
Yeah, we're live. Hello.
Hello, welcome. Welcome to the Sports Car Safari podcast, episode 2. We're here with obviously co-editor Luke Jaxer, myself, Andrew Coles, and joining us this time we have Andy Sarandis, sandwiches.
Sardines.
Sardine, welcome. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Very
Thanks
good, very good.
for having me.
Just so
No
just for
worries.
everyone out there, can you spell your name and pronounce it properly?
It's pretty easy. Sarandis. Sarandis.
No apostrophes, punctuation in that.
No,
It's
I've
just as
had
a
that before, but
yep.
not native.
Good. I must admit it, as most good memes do on the internet, I didn't quite understand the jokes because I've never really found it a particularly challenging surname. But well, that's good. So anyway, yeah, well, welcome, Andy. Those of you in the Australian motorsport community are probably familiar with Andy's various exploits around in both sides of the car, as a driver in improved production behind the wheel of an immaculately prepared Lancer Evo 8, and as a co-driver in national level gravel rally, sitting in some modern R5 cars and everything in between, and a day job as well, managing Autosport, the retailer in Adelaide that sells a lot of helmets and race suits and race equipment and gear. So pretty well embedded into the motorsport scene, we'd say. So
Yeah, do a bit of everything. Sort of can't get away from it sometimes. But yeah, it's been good last few years, especially doing a lot of the rally stuff. That's definitely added another dimension to things that I haven't had as much of previously. But yeah, certainly it's nice to be able to tick all the boxes in various areas.
So I guess one question I did have, how much of your time is spent? Like, well, how much free time do you have? Because I've noticed follow your updates on social media, and it seems like you do all of the prep work on the Evo yourself in terms of engine builds and outs, and obviously anyone who's maintained a competition car knows that keeping it at that standard is almost a full-time job on its own. Then you add in the co-driving side of things with obviously the prep to compete at that level is an incredible amount of planning and preps and that, and then obviously working full-time as well. And I believe you're involved as well in improved production from a sort of an organizational standpoint too. So yeah, how do you fit it all in?
It gets busy. There's definitely some times of year where you go from the shed and straight from the shed to home to get on a plane and go somewhere. But yeah, it still works too bad. You've got a little sort of prep regime, I guess you do before meetings. And to be honest, I haven't actually driven my car all that much the last couple of years, so that's probably made it easier as well. I've done a few bigger events rather than doing series or anything. So the plan was this year to try and do all the four state rounds, but obviously
Well,
the coronavirus is part of
that might be an easily attainable goal at this stage,
I'd be happy to do one. But yeah, look, it certainly keeps me busy from an involvement point of view with improved production as well. I'm currently club president for the South Australian club, so there's sort of always something to do going on there as well, be it organizing events or other bits and pieces. But yeah, I guess it's all part of it. I wouldn't do it if I didn't like it. So
So what's improved production racing, just for everyone out there who hasn't actually heard of it? You're
So,
crazy as one, but what is it exactly?
where have you been? Look, it's basically production-based cars that we're allowed limited modifications. So we're sort of in between production cars and sports sedans. So, engine-wise, there's some freedoms and stuff, but in terms of bodywork and aero, they're very basic, almost basically a standard car. So yeah, we're sort of Australia-wide category. There's about 400 members, I think, Australia-wide. There's quite a lot. So yeah, it's one of the bigger categories in the country.
And the thing I find interesting, because if you actually, I was sort of reflecting on this, it has probably one of the most banal names for a racing series in the world, like improved production. That doesn't mean like great, you've put some stripes on or something, but really what we've got, what you have, is a racing category where I was thinking about this, where you know, watching some of your YouTube videos and clips, is that each of the different cars racing. So for those that don't know, you know, Andy has a Lancer Evolution 8. There's
Just bring that up. Hang on.
Yeah.
Just so people
pictures can see. You know, there's Datsun 1200s. There's, you know, S13 Silvias. There's, you know, absolutely everything. But what I find fascinating about the racing is that the individual strengths of the cars come through in the races. So obviously, you know, every race start that you have is basically driving, swerving off the grid between cars that look like they're parked cars because you have that traction. But then, you know, Ray Hislop's V8 Falcon sort of gobbles you up on the straights and yeah, but yet the racing remains so close and competitive.
Yeah, we're all limited in some way. Obviously, I've got good traction being a four-wheel drive car, but all the turbo cars in the category have to run a restrictor, so which goes in the front of the turbo, and that's a sliding scale now off the weight of the car, which has helped a bit, cars like mine. Yeah. But yeah, look, everyone's got advantages. That, you know, Datsun's weigh nothing, but they've got leaf springs in the back of them and they're only running a 205 tyre. So, yeah, there's definitely, an art to each, you know, each car in the category, and each one's got its own strengths and weaknesses. And that's why the racing's so good because, yeah, like you say, race cars are jet in a straight line, but, you know, you can make it up in other areas to sort of hopefully achieve the overall lap time about the same or quicker.
So I guess as well, like, you know, I guess improved production shot to global fame. And I mean, I was in the UK here when you guys first raced it at Adelaide's Clipsal 500 race as a support act to what's now Supercars. And I find it's funny because, you know, these big events that we have in Australia, you know, South Australia is a bit of a bubble, and you think that the Clipsal was this huge event, but then you come to Europe and America and no one's even heard of Adelaide, you know, let alone that event. But but those YouTube clips, they cut through the noise, and suddenly they were being shared on Jalopnik, they were being shared on Autoblog, all the big websites. It went around, and I had my mates in the UK coming to me saying, like, what's this improved production? You know, where's what is it? Where do I start? Like, you know.
It was arguably the most exciting racing of that event.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at views are to go off, it certainly was. And I mean, even look at, you know, someone like Jordan Cox, who obviously had the clips from both Clipsal and then Bathurst that year as well. And his career has basically gone from, you know, strength to strength from that.
Well, he's doing TCR now, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, he is. Yeah. So, and look, to be fair, very good driver, has earned his spot and deservedly so. But I think it's a good story of someone who genuinely is a fast driver. And I think you could probably take the top 5 or 10 drivers in IP and put them in a TCR car or something else, and they'd probably be as competitive as Jordan would be. I think that's a good reflection on the category as to how good the level of racing is.
Yeah. So what was it like, the race at Adelaide that time?
That's just ticking the bucket list thing. I think for battlers like us to be able to go to something you've dreamed of being at since you were a kid. I mean, I've been going since I was, you know, 10, 11, something like that. And, you know, go along with Dad every year. And to be able to go there and do that event and drive on the same track and then let alone all the coverage post that with TV or whatever, it was, that whole weekend was just a crazy, crazy experience, that's for sure.
Fantastic. And, I hats off to you because I you know, to be able to drive that hard on that track where one error is going to result in a seriously damaged car and for you to walk away from that a couple of years in a row with no real major damage. Because I know there was a lot of...
There was one year.
Maybe slightly more damage the second year than the first one. That was a weekend that hasn't been one of the better ones. But
what happened in that? So do you want to explain the story about what happened? I'll find some pictures and bring it up.
I qualified third in the, I think, and started the first race, and I had Ray Hislop and Chris Brown in front of me.
Which were also excited you got third place.
That and also that's phenomenal. So that's what a V8 Falcon, BA Falcon, and a 86 Toyota,
to put that
which
in perspective,
has...
like Ray's Falcon's 700 and plus horsepower car. Chris Brown's car is probably one of the top fastest cars in the country. We all qualified, I think, within about 2/10 of each other, which for IP is quite crazy because normally it's a lot more spread out. It was starting behind those two, and it was like, right, I've got to get the best start of my life and get out of here. And I did that. Yep. Unfortunately, my wiring for my fuel pump in the fuse panel didn't like all the curb strikes, and I had the car turn off on me sort of end of the, well, basically just after the start of the second lap whilst leading. So that wasn't brilliant. And then, yeah, starting from the back of the grid in race two, I got tangled up into turn nine, Trobby being a bit ambitious under brakes. And and then,
I'm trying to find that picture because it's a good picture. It's like the main like kind of crash.
Yeah, well, one of you guys took it, I think. So, it's just a massive bottleneck. I think it was three wide and I was on the very inside and basically had nowhere to go. So, yeah, it's one of those things. It's about the only accident I think I've had whilst racing. So I've probably been incredibly, fairly lucky. So
touch wood now. But I just think it's such a fantastic story. I mean, a friend of ours, a friend of Sportscar Safari's, Drew Milne. And if Drew's listening today, hi. But I remember one thing that, you know, Drew raced Formula Ford for many years. And I remember he had quite an old, I think, a Van Diemen RF92, and he would enter the Clipsal, you know, the Formula Ford race there every year. And his sort of point was that, you know, and that really opened my eyes that, okay, motorsport's expensive, that there's no way of getting around that. But a lot of this stuff, actually, if you really, you know, are driven and are eager and want to do it, you can do it. And Drew was sort of saying, like, okay, I haven't won, you know, a national championship, but I know what it's like to drive down the main straight on the Sunday of race weekend at Clipsal with, you know, 20,000 people in the grandstands. And I was like, that's something that not very many people can say. Like, that's very cool.
That's like, definitely, I think, the massive draw card. I'd always been quite keen for us to try and get into it because as a category, like you've been saying, the racing's great to watch. It's a lot more interesting than some of the processional stuff that was there this year. But, you know, it was great. We had our president at the time was Jamie Weir, and I can't exactly remember how it all came about, but I think he basically wrote a letter or spoke to someone in charge of organising the thing, and 6 months later we were in. And I still remember the call. He rang me and said, we've got in, and that was that call was like a bit surreal, like, wow, this is actually going to be a thing. And then you know, we had to pick from, I think we had 80 cars that applied to get in for about 30 spots. So that first year was just the whole bars and everyone at that event was just a crazy weekend.
And I remember, like, it's very good that it was good, because I remember there was some concern at the time about, you know, the reliability of cars or the quality of drivers, because it's a very unforgiving track, you know, designed for professionals, and getting, you know, effectively amateur drivers to do it, you know, and you guys put an exemplary performance on. It was none of those problems, really.
It's funny you say that, because it's probably the only improved production event to date where I think one car failed to finish the whole weekend. we started the last race with one less than when we started the weekend, which never happens. So it was definitely pretty good. And look, even like you say, with people, you know, having issues or whatever and getting off the track, we're the only category that weekend that didn't have a safety car, which says a fair bit as well.
The Adelaide Street Circuit is just like unheard of. Like, there's always a safety car. There's always someone that puts it into the wall or blows an engine or something like that.
Yeah.
The one car that didn't finish that blew an engine, he actually cranked the car in reverse on the starter motor to back it behind the wall. So, yeah, it was definitely some special efforts to avoid that happening, which was great.
That's fantastic. And then, of course, you've also raced at Bathurst, which is again something that not many people can say they've done. What was that like?
Scary. I'd have to say, you know, been in a fair few cars and done quite a lot of events, but not scared myself too much. That place is genuinely intimidating to try and go there and then drive on the pace of the front guys. It's definitely somewhere where you need laps and you need experience, because it just, you can't make up for that. I think I went a couple of seconds quicker between the race on Saturday and the last race Sunday morning, just from thinking about it and doing more laps. You just, the more track time you can get there, the better. And, you know, looking at, you know, someone like Jordan Cox is a great example, goes there and just completely goes full send across the top of the hill. That's That's pretty ballsy, I reckon.
If anyone out there, YouTube, we'll pop the link in, but YouTube, Jordan Cox Bathurst improved production and that those passing moves and what he's doing in the little Civic, the little EG Civic, you just shouldn't be able to do that and get away with that on so many occasions.
There's a fair bit of kindness given to him on a couple of occasions from a few of the other guys as well. If that was, you know, you try and do that in TCR or something, you'll end up over the fence and back down in the pits.
Was that the year that we were there, like together, or was that a different year?
That was last year that I went. You mean for me or for Jordan?
That time where Jordan was like flying over the top of the hill, because I remember
been. I have a feeling I wasn't there that year. You might have been up there, but
I was definitely there for that one.
Yeah, I was watching on the live stream that year, but it was great to watch.
The best bit was because it was McPhillamy Park up the top of the hill, like hearing the campers that were up there, the crowd that was up there just going bananas for this little Civic gone nuts at the top of the hill was the best. Like arguably that they were screaming much louder than what there was for the GT3 cars going around there.
No doubt.
Because Andrew, do you remember the first time that we went to Bathurst in 2014?
That was a great weekend.
The first week I went to the Bathurst 12-hour, which if nobody's been, just got to get there. Like no matter where you are in the world, it's just a phenomenal track and it's a phenomenal experience and, good Australian culture, camp in the middle of the ground and everything, which is fantastic. But that first year we went there, we cannonballed it overnight to Bathurst, which we'll get Michael Busby on the line at some point. We'll get him on there. Buzz, if you're watching, you got to get on here. And we cannonballed overnight. We ended up at Bathurst early in the morning. I think it was IPRA that was like one of the first groups that were on.
Yeah.
And we trekked up the top of the hill. And one of the things about improved production that was great was just the E85. Like it was hot. We were behind the cars coming into the dipper and we just got face full E85 and burnt our eyes, but it was just like the best thing. Overnight cannonball, which is
funny how that's changed. It used to be Avgas and now it's E85. And you can't even go to a historic meeting with that anymore.
I have a memory, and I know this makes me, probably feel old, but I can definitely remember when my dad would run Avgas in the Alpha for Malala, and you'd drive out to Parafield Airport and you'd pull up at the fence, and I remember this, and the truck would drive over across the grass and would literally fill your jerry cans up over the fence, and you'd pay him in cash, and that's how you'd got your Avgas. We're officially old now.
You were supposed to keep that secret, I think. That was definitely some bootleg sale. We went to OG Speed Shop, I remember that.
Did you put it in the lawnmower though, Andrew? Did you guys put it in the lawnmower?
Yeah, the end of the season. What are you going to do with, a few litres of Avgas in November?
Put it in the lawnmower.
I think the world needs to, I think there's a lot of new categories coming out now, TCR, which has taken over. And I think improved production really is something that is very applicable in other parts of the world because, one thing I love international GT racing, GT3, like, and GT4 and whatnot, fantastic, brilliant. But there's a slight little twinge when you're at a race and you're like, a Bentley Continental GT should not be keeping pace with a McLaren 720S. And it's just, they're all so evenly matched and it's great, but those racing cars are not representative really of what the road cars can do. Whereas improved production is exactly that. The cars sound different, they look different, they behave differently in the corners, and they're all broadly speaking competitive. And I think it's something that definitely in Europe and the States, I think, definitely has a place.
It's funny you say that, though, because TCR, I went up to the bend and had a look at, when the round was up there, had a look at the cars. They're surprisingly very IP-esque. They've got a bit bigger wing and they've got slicks and they've got a fancy gearbox. But if you look under the bonnet of the Audi, that's very much looks like a road car almost, and they don't have bespoke suspension stuff from what I could see. A lot of it was, a lot of you ran KW or whatever suspensions, but the actual arms and the uprights, I think a lot of that stuff is either spec'd. I think all the rear brakes on them looked all the same, but they're actually very not unmodified in a lot of ways compared to, you know, other categories that we had, like 3 or something like that.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool to see that and go, hey, these are actually not that dissimilar from a street car.
So what do you think? I mean, obviously, you know, what's happening in the Australian car industry is heartbreaking to see, but really TCR has a hell of a lot more relevance to any sort of Australian racing than supercars does these days.
Affordable. If you've got some money, you can afford to do TCR. Supercars and I guess GT3 as well has got to a point where you need, I don't know, $1 million a year to do Dunlop Series or whatever it is. And whereas if you've got 300, which you know, be nice if you did, but you know, there's people there with money that want to go racing, but you can't get into those categories because it's so limited in what's on offer and the drives on offer. If you want to do TCR, it's like buying an R5 car. You can buy one and you can just about turn up and race, which is a good concept.
Gary Rogers Motorsport.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
He pulled out of supercars and straight into TCR. Yeah. So.
Look at the grid size. That's a good indication as to, and they're not all young guys and girls trying to get somewhere. There's older guys that have, you know, Michael King, who's an improved production guy.
Yep.
He's gone and bought a Hyundai and he's going to run this year. So
fantastic. You know,
it's affordable if you've got the cash there to do it.
Yeah, and I guess as well, the thing I find, if you're, you know, Renault Australia, you're Audi, you're one of these importers, you know, I mean, to run a supercars team, it's not the cars and the cost. It's you need a workshop, you need an engineering team, you need an engine development program, you need all of these very expensive things. Whereas if you're a medium-sized vehicle importer and you can purchase, lease a couple of cars, sub it out to a team like Gary Rogers to run it for you, it becomes quite a good return on investment from a marketing sort of investment.
Look at Hyundai. Hyundai had, at the Bend round, they had driver, like, people up there with i30Ns and they had a display. There was quite a bit of manufacturer stuff up there, which it's clearly a thing for them where, hey, look, we've got this car and it's racing on the track and it's not that different from what's available on the road.
Yeah. I guess that's quite similar to rally. Like, one of my vivid memories as a kid was heading out to Kaipo Forest and Mount Crawford Forest and everything and having a look around and being a young kid and going through the car park to get to the special stages and seeing a STI and an Evo and stuff like that, like early ones. You know, they're very vivid memories of going through and being like, oh, wow, like there's a race car. Like there's the car that I see on the track, which is, you know, I guess part of the appeal of that and the broader appeal that I think is getting a bit lost now with supercars and some of the other categories where like TCR and improved production is a great way to, I guess, relate and interact with the racing that's going on.
Well, I think a lot of the improved production guys, I mean, I this car that I've got now is my second car, improved production car that I've built. First one was my street car. You know, I had a Toyota Sprinter
that I used to
deliver pizzas in, and it got too modified to probably really drive on the street. And I turned that into an IP car. And there's a heap of guys. Chris Brown's car. There's a lot of cars. We're all street cars. There were things in the shed.
Is that the
one? Yeah, that's not, not that one.
The 86. That thing sounded glorious. And then, of course, you went and did Classic Adelaide in that with Bosby as well.
Yeah, Bosby, the rookie rally. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Top left. That's not long after I had it as a street car still. That was at All Japan Day or something like that. It ended up with a fancy 4AG in it, and then I did a few. I started doing super sprints and was like, well, what else can I do? obviously IP came along and I've ended up putting a 2-litre Beams 3S motor out of a IS200 Lexus Altezza for the international people. It was a great little car. Me and Buzz did the rally, rookie rally in it. And we ended up winning that here and ended up going and doing Targa High Country, which was
the Adelaide rally.
So yeah, that was Classic Adelaide, Adelaide. What was it called? Targa Adelaide then.
Targa Adelaide. Yeah, Adelaide.
That was the year that you guys did Showgrounds.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it was 2 years. Yeah, it was 2 years. Yeah, yeah. The first year I did the Showgrounds as the sprint thing, like as the, the opener to the rally. That was when there was like 20,000 people up trees.
So just to interrupt. So obviously rallying is quite, you know, in the hills and spread out, and you've got to be pretty dedicated to get out to a stage. And I highly recommend anyone to make the effort to get out, because it is just the best motorsport that is out there. But yeah, they had in the showgrounds, they mapped out at what a 1.5 kilometer course, and they ran
service roads between the buildings,
and it was a bit sketchy. I was co-driving with Guy Standen in that event as well, and it was a bit sketchy, you know. It was good fun, but you know, to a motorsport event in South Australia, you know, 4,000-5,000 people, it would be classed as an overwhelming success. And they had like 20,000 people turned up to watch this.
They couldn't put anybody in.
People,
I remember we were sitting in the pavilion because they had all the cars on display, and they were waiting to try and get us out. And we ended up like threading through a crowd of people just to get onto it. It was ridiculous. It took like 45 minutes just to get to the start. Yeah. You had to do this special path because there were so many people.
I remember Guy and I, we were...
If you're listening, we need this event. We need this back again. not the showgrounds just as a service park area. We need to go back and use it as a special stage.
I remember tearing. I was co-driving with Guy Stand in the Fiat 124 CC, the rally car, and we were tearing down that straight at the back of the showgrounds, and you've got the big spoon drains, and you're boom, bang, and you know, over, and we're sort of belting down, and this weird camber's going on, and because it's not designed to be driven at speed, and then I remember looking up, and there was people on the roof of some of the pavilions. Like, they had, you know, this is stuff you see in Europe, you see it in Spain, in Portugal, you don't see this in Australia. And it was just the most incredible.
It's funny you say about those spoon drains. So years ago, when I was a lot younger and Dad was service crewing for a couple of the internationals, there was a guy that came over from I think it was from Scotland. He had a Lotus Cortina, and Dad had a Lotus Cortina, so he wanted to service. And they had the internationals. This is the week before the event, and they had the internationals stored at the showgrounds in one of the pavilions. And we turned up maybe the Sunday beforehand, and we got there, and there was a guy with a Cortina, and there was another fella with a BDA Escort. There was a couple of escorts, and we got there, and they had one of the escorts up in the air, and they were bucking around underneath it. And anyway, so Dad jumps in this Cortina with this crazy Scotsman, and they go belting off down like that back where you would have gone down the back road there. And they hit this spoon drain, which at that point was about a foot deep. And this thing's like launched itself across the roadway, through the gate, landed like on the road still going along. He's like, oh, shit, I forgot that was there. And they were straightening because the guys in the other car had just been down there and done the same thing. And when we got there, they were straightening the sump guard up. So, yeah, it's lucky they probably filled them in because it wouldn't have been much good otherwise.
Yeah, that was – I think it just proves that, you know, this motorsport has had declining crowds and you know, these problems. But I think really it is just a matter of, you know, you hit the sweet spot of what people really want. You make it easy for them to come to and easy for them to compete and participate, and you get that mix right. It's there, the support's there. So, so I guess it's an interesting segue into rallying while we're on the subject. So you're one of the few people who can discuss competing at, you know, top level national and improved production, but also co-driving. So, you know, R5 Fiestas, R5 Skodas with Steve Glennie, some of the best drivers in Australia. Tell us how did that come about? How did you get into it?
I've been spoiled in that regard. So I knew Steve through work, was a customer at the shop.
Which we'll touch on later,
And two, I'd sort of been away quite a bit. He'd obviously done a fair bit of co-driving with Ben Calder. And I'd been away to various tarmac rallies and service for those two because they're pretty entertaining to go rallying with. and basically I think we were at the – it was for the Adelaide Rally. I think we were at the Arkaba at the pre-briefing or something. Anyway, we were there and Steve said, oh, I think I'm going to drive next year in the ARC. Do you want to come co-drive for me? And I was sort of like, oh, I can't co-drive. Like, you know, me and Buzz had done, I think, five events, a handful of stuff. And he was like, oh, don't worry about the notes. I just want someone I can put up with in a car. Like, you know, they get along with for a week. and it'll be fun. I was like, okay, yeah, cool, no worries. So yeah, that was basically
which is 50% of co-driving, right? Not being a pain in the ass in the
car. Oh no, absolutely. You've got to get along, otherwise it's no point in being there. Basically, it's, you know, part of the fun is having fun and doing the event and being, you know, with someone locked in a confined space for a week. So yeah.
But also, like, you know, from a driver and a co-driver's standpoint, you perform better when you're relaxed and having fun anyway. If you're trying too hard to you know, overcome some tension or something, you're not doing a good job as a co-driver.
Yeah, you've got to be comfortable with each other, or just, dynamic doesn't work. But yeah, like that whole program that Craig Brooks put together, which was Subaru that he's put together, which he got Jason White, Pete Nunn. He's basically assembled the world's fastest service crew. I hate to think how many rallies have been together with them, but there's an amazing group of guys there that have a lot of knowledge. And that car, the current one's even better than the one we're in. But the one we're in is amazing compared to everything else at the time until the R5 cars came along.
And this is that bright orange Subaru, because you guys were carrying a bit of a weight penalty, weren't you, versus the factory car of Molly Taylor. Is that something I've heard? Is the truth to that? Or
no, so Molly had the weight penalty on us.
Okay.
That Subaru was actually Molly's old car. That was the championship winning car, I think.
Yeah.
I think they took about 300 kilos out of it.
Oh, wow. I got that completely wrong.
Yeah, no, so that car was actually nearly the lightest thing in the field, and there was actually a competition, I think, between Craig and Neil Bates to see who could be the lightest on the scales that he's scrutineering, which is pretty funny. There was something in there about Whitey's eating his welding helmet, but I'm not sure what that story was. He never ate it. So,
how did that season go? What was it like stepping in? Because most co-drivers sort of start at the bottom and gradually work their way up, and by the time you get to compete at national level, you're pretty well versed in what you're doing. But you're sort of going straight into the frying pan. Like, how was that?
Yeah, so my introduction for that season was I did Targa Northwest with Steve in a Buckby-prepared STI, so similar car, but tarmac version. And it was basically like, see how you go with this, and then we'll do Targa Taz with no recce. And and then go from there. So I think I did Targa Taz. That was my sort of practice. And then we went a week later from there to Perth and did the first round of the ARC. I missed the first round because I was with Clipsal. He'd done Ballarat. It was a pretty big learning curve.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, I mean, I've been to Targa Tassie. I've service crewed for Guy and yourself, but I've never actually driven or co-driven in the event.
Mm.
In terms of baptism of fire, Andrew, what level is that on?
It's a pretty steep learning curve if you don't know what you're doing. I mean, I've done a bit of co-driving. I would not hesitate at all to say that I'm experienced by any stretch of the imagination. I've done a handful of events, you know, and had a lot of fun. And obviously there's a big delineation between myself and Andy. You know, when Guy Stannard and myself go out, we're going out purely to have fun and to enjoy the event. Andy's going to win. So there's a very big difference in approach there. But I found Targa Tasmania, it's a long event, it's 6 days. There's a lot of driving. You're crossing the entire island state of Tasmania. And really it comes down to fatigue management, because you go down there, you do recce. The event doesn't start on day one. The event starts 3-4 days earlier when you drive across, you catch the ferry across, you set the car up, you've got recce, you know. And fatigue is the big thing. And by sort of about day three, you start to really get tired and you realize you're not even at the halfway mark. And that for me was the big one of, okay, we really, you know, I'm more like, no, we'll stay up, we'll go have a beer, like it's fine. But no, in Tasmania, you really do need to manage.
I think you actually said that to me. I think your advice was like, if you get a chance to go to bed, because you just need every bit of energy you can get.
Yeah.
And you definitely find yourself trying to sort of almost not wake yourself up, you're still awake and you're still alert, but that sharpness just drops away.
Yeah,
and it's really, really tricky, especially when you're going as quick as with Steve, you do with Steve driving.
Yeah.
You've got to be so on the ball, and the minute you drop 5%, you just you're not there anymore. It doesn't work. So
I found the trickiest bit for me was when we'd finish a stage and you'd have this, you know, Arrowsmith or one of the great stages, and you'd have this spike of adrenaline and you're on top of the world. And then you've got a 50, 60 kilometer transport. So the adrenaline comes down, you discuss, you know, you settle in, and there's no navigating to do it. It's just jump on the highway and drive for an hour. And then you start to sort of do these ones. You start to nod off, and then you arrive at the start of the next stage in a relaxed semi-sleep mode, and you've got to then bring yourself back up to, like, okay, you know.
A big part of it is trying to switch yourself on and wake yourself back up, especially, like, what day is it? The day you drive from Launceston to Hobart, and you go, or no, Strawn to Hobart. There's a transport there that is, it's like an hour and a half, and it is just dead boring. You're in this thing that's droning away, and you're just trying to, like, oh, come on, hurry up. Get this done. But yeah, it's really difficult when you do that. You then go have lunch, and then you've just eaten something, and then go, oh, hang on, now I've got to go wake up and go switch on and read notes again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even as like a support team for like service crewing, even just trying to get around and lug things around and, you know, get from point A to point B, let alone doing it at 10 tents. It's just exhausting in itself.
I still reckon the service guys have probably got it nearly as hard. You're getting up earlier and driving further and doing more. So,
and you know, you're trying to rebuild gearboxes overnight in a shed with no power.
There's definitely no envy there. I think I'd still much rather be in the car.
There was some, I think I like, you know, that for the service crews, for those that don't know, like, a lot of the parts of, you know, western, sort of southwestern Tasmania, there's not a lot of roads in. And the roads that they use for the rally are often, you know, Is it Strawn, I think?
Yeah,
Strawn. Where the only road out of Strawn is the first stage of the day.
Yeah.
So basically, if you're a service crew, you're either getting out at 4 a.m. before the rally starts at, you know, 7 a.m. or you're there until 11 a.m. at the end of the day. So there's every year, you know, people warned us that you know, the service crew exodus out of Strawn at 5 a.m. is a bit of a mad dash of guys in sprinter vans loaded, you know, and everyone's just, you know, and that the event is like a whole lot of small events within a big event.
There's a certain white hot service van that is the fastest thing in the country. you could put that on a stage, it'd probably be okay, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've gone from Tiger Taz, you've done that, which, you know, for a lot of people, that's the goal, is to do Tiger Tasmania. How did you finish up in that first event?
We were second in the end outright, which was, pretty cool experience. That's especially in a little Subaru that they made weigh about 1,700 kilos for the rules, and they basically give you no modifications, and then you've got to go chase Vipers and Porsches. So, yeah, it was interesting week, but good fun. An amazing experience. Yeah. You can't buy that at all. So, in terms of experience, of the learning experience of notes and all sorts of aspects of it, it was definitely a massive thing. Then go to WA and go to gravel. You're sort of almost going to relearn, because it's a lot of differences.
But also, I think, you know, you touched on the notes there. It's worth mentioning for people that might not be in the sport. So, I would say a fair part of the field at most rallies in Australia run on what's called Smoothline notes. So a company called Smoothline put together notes, and, you know, that they are expensive, but they do save you money, because you don't need to recce and write your own notes, and they're bloody good. Obviously, what you might not realize is that Steve Glennie is the person writing the Smoothline notes. So in terms of people to learn from and to sit alongside while you're learning, like, you probably, there's no one.
I don't think there's probably a more qualified teacher around. Even just with a lot of people, it's funny with those notes to mention that, because people say, I don't like this call, or I take that out. And you ask them if they know what it means, and they go, oh, no, not really. So then you explain it to them. Or he was explaining it to me, as you do, and they go, okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then they sort of, I think it's an understanding to get that knowledge right, and then you can use what's there. So having him telling me all of that, and he's still doing sightseeing mid-stage. Oh, there's that cliff I was talking about. I'm doing this. Definitely a good teacher, and certainly I think it's been the learning process and the, you know, that side of things massively.
Yeah. So you've gone in and you've, you've then done the rest of the National Gravel Championship in the Subaru. How did you go? What was that?
So that was a tricky year. Where did we come? We come second in the end. It was really close going into Rally Australia. There was ourselves, Eli Evans and Harry Bates mm-hmm. that were sort of all in contention. And Molly, I think, even at that stage mm-hmm. for the title. And we'd basically been battling all year to try and keep up with an R5 Skoda. And that was sort of the first real foray into the championship from someone from a serious point of view. Mm-hmm. Multiple events. And obviously Harry's car just got quicker and quicker and quicker. The thing, I guess, at that mm-hmm. stage, they hadn't quite got the reliability in it. And that yeah. probably helped.
And this is the Yaris, isn't it?
That's the Yaris, yep.
Yeah.
Which obviously last year they got everything sorted and just went and just drove away from everybody.
Just everyone.
So we were in a long wheelbase Subaru, if you like, compared to some of the other cars. Basically just trying to keep up and go as quick as we could go, which was definitely a challenge against those much shorter wheelbase cars, which once you get in one and sort of see how they are, you go, okay, I see now where we're sort of losing time.
So how did you guys step up to the R5? Because you've done that now.
Yeah, so we may have sort of bent Brooks's car a little bit. You know, unfortunately, so he was kind enough to organise an R5 for Rally Australia, which was, definitely a really cool experience. And then, it was sort of a case of swap sides of the car because obviously you've gone from a right-hand drive car to a left-hand drive one. And try and learn a whole thing and do an event, which, was fun in itself.
So just set the scene here because, you can be honest, as honest or as
vague as you like.
Vague as you like. But you're at Rally Australia. You're at a WRC event. You're in an R5 car. You're rubbing shoulders with all of the top drivers in the world. Did you just subconsciously in your mind go, I'm pretty top shit right now. I think I've made it. Or because I would be going, this is pretty cool.
I thought when I did Clipstall, that was about as good as it'll get. And you think, that's pretty cool. Get to do that event. And then to be at Rally Australia, I'm standing in a regroup, I think it was, and I've literally got Sebastian Ogier standing next to me.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him and he's sort of trying to avoid eye contact, like, who's this weirdo? I'm thinking, this is pretty cool.
You didn't giggle at him, did you?
No, I didn't. I was probably staring like a weirdo.
You know, one of the favorite thing I think I've almost ever read on the internet was that famous Bill Caswell story of when they rocked up to Rally Mexico in the E30 and parking alongside Loeb. And that's for those that don't know, if you search Jalopnik Bill Caswell, you'll find this story. And basically, they did the cheapest possible entry into a WRC event just to say they could do it, and then just to basically take the piss alongside all of the world's best drivers. But it's kind of that experience, but you're in one of their cars playing at their level, like on the same timesheets.
I think even the special stage it was, they would have it on the foreshore there, it's bitumen sort of thing they set up. And we were one of the first cars into it because they sort of regroup everybody and reorder it for TV. And so we went through and then it rained, like it absolutely poured. And I think we were fifth or sixth or something outright, and we'd beaten Tanak and all these people. And so there's this screenshot with Glennie and Sarandis with Tanak and then all these other, all these other hacks who've only won a whole bunch of world championships. Don't have to know it was raining, but it's
do you have that timesheet printed and framed on your wall? Because I should tell you.
I was going to say, did they actually spell your name right, though? That's important.
Yeah, they did. No, they got it right. Mine's easy on that one.
And are the rumours, the stories I hear from the post WRC party true? I've heard that it's just a great experience.
I missed out. I was that event is seriously the hardest thing I've done. It's harder than Target Taz. I got to Sunday and we were leading at that point, leading ARC and WRC 2 or whatever, and I think we were in the lead by about 18 minutes because Eli had nosedived on Friday, I think, and bent his car.
Harry's car had a mechanical, and Molly, I can't remember, something happened. Anyway, but yeah, we're ahead by so far, and it was like, well, we still want to keep going fast because we're in this cool car, and we might as well try. But you sort of going, oh, don't stuff this up, don't stuff that up, and you just sort of trying to not muck something up because you're that far ahead. If you, it's going to be a my mistake more than Steve's that's going to cause a problem. So
yeah.
Yeah. But it's definitely, we did the power stage and we were second car through, which was cool as well. And we got to the end and they go, okay, go stand in that media pen. And so we're standing there and there's various other WRC guys. And then like Tommy Macken walks in and the head boss of Toyota and all these people. And they're standing, same thing, they're standing, you know, half a meter away. Yeah. And even Steve's looking at me like, check out who that is. If you look at the footage from the WRC Live, when Toyota wins the championship, and they're standing there with their flags and they're waving around and there's these two battlers in the background just going, hey. it was
fantastic.
That experience alone is, I'll never forget that. It was really cool.
Yeah.
So how do you think, you know, on that subject? I mean, my take of the situation, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Steve, with his talent, if he was a decade earlier when there was proper manufacturer budgets and funding and could have got a work right, where would he be now? Like, does he have the raw talent and skill to sort of be up there competing on an international level? And it's just sort of circumstance that has led to
that? He'd certainly be out of any of the Australians, I would have thought. Up there with any of them. I think he just signed with Mitsubishi when Mitsubishi pulled out globally. So he sort of just missed the boat, unfortunately. Because who knows? Certainly as good as anyone I would have thought that's been at that level.
Because I know, you know, obviously that the glory days of, well, not the glory days. That's the wrong term. We're in a good time now, but you know the 90s.
You're not old enough to be doing that yet, Andrew.
I know. But you know the 90s. When you had the factory Subarus and Mitsubishi and Toyota sort of, you know, and I don't want to knock, you know, the legend of Possum Bourne and Neil Bates and all those guys, but they were very, I guess, blessed in the fact that their careers sort of peaked at the same time that the industry was peaking, that the budgets were peaking, that it was sort of on for young and old. And that generation of drivers that came a decade later kind of missed out on a lot of those opportunities that might
it's
have
just
been
so much
there.
Harder now. There's no opportunity in terms of, look at the WRC field. What if you got 8 seats? For 20 something people that are all probably deserve to be there. You know, you look at this year with how many drivers, Rosberg and those guys that are not in a WRC car. Undoubtedly there was a lot more opportunity there in terms of numbers and probably budget on the table for people. But I think, you know, you look at what Toyota's doing at the moment with Harry and Lewis. And you know, even up until this year with Subaru with Molly, they're still there and still running a program, even if it's not on the scale of what it was 10 years ago.
Yep. So then you obviously had the R5 experience in the Skoda, and then that then moved into the Fiesta. So you're in the M Sport R5 Fiesta last year.
I've been spoiled. And the plan is to do the same this year, but if we ever get to go rallying again. Sort of got to know Luke through Steve. Steve had done a little bit of, done a first few events with Luke. I guess maybe not a lot of people realise with Luke. Luke started, I think his first rally was the Tiger Northwest that I did 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And I think I'm pretty sure that was his first event, like full stop, and that was in a Focus, almost, you know, like road car that's been converted.
Yeah.
I think he's done an amazing job of stepping up to that plate to be somewhere near those guys. That level is definitely not to be underestimated, I think, in terms of how fast people are. And look, anyone even in the ARC that's sort of top 5 or 6 is definitely quality speed wise.
Yeah. So what's it like at an R5? You know, I mean, is it as good as we all think it would be?
It's pretty good.
It has to be that good. There's no way it can't be that good.
I think they're not fast. Like, they don't have a lot of power. They're probably, I don't know, 170 kilowatts, something like that, and no torque because they're a little engine. But they're just so efficient. there's no, like the Subaru, you'd come out of a corner and there'd be a bit of a delay as it sort of tried to scrabble for traction and get going up the road, whereas an R5, it's pretty much just no drop. It just, it's constantly accelerating. And the way the gearbox is set up in them, and they're very short ratio, and they just keep accelerating. And the sort of the direction change in them is absolutely ridiculous. They swap ends. They will spin if you jump on the wrong brakes at the wrong spot. as demonstrated by us a couple of times.
Yeah. Fantastic. And how are they to run? You know, is it a, you know, a very intensive car to run and maintain, or are they actually pretty good?
They're very reliable if you do the maintenance, it seems to be. They're not cheap to actually maintain in terms of dollars per kilometre.
Yeah.
Certainly compared to a, you know, Group N state level car or something like that. That said, compared to probably anything else running in the ARC, like Brooksy's car, for example, they're probably not significantly different. It's relative to big dollars for a state level car, but for something that's national, it's probably to be expected at that cost.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I kind of noticed about it too was they're just fast in, fast out cars compared to those, like, you know, the standard Subarus that you guys were running before and stuff like that. They're just so quick, and it was actually really good at Adelaide Rally last year to see one on tarmac, because that's something we don't really get often in Australia, is the, you know, tarmac how fast stuff. That's always usually reserved for gravel. So that was really cool to see them out running about and you know, getting a bit of bow roll and throwing some hurries and stuff like that.
Sean O'Dowd's car, which did Adelaide Rally last year, that was great. Sort of surprised to see how it went on the faster stuff, which, because I think they do, the Ford anyway does about 165 and or maybe 170, and that sort of runs out of revs, and the Skoda would be much the same. So on those stages that have got 200k an hour plus stuff, you get destroyed. I think Monato stage here, which has got, I think we were sitting on the rev limiter in top gear on one of the straights for the whole thing, and meanwhile Guy Tyler's in his Evo 7 doing 220 and by about 30 seconds, and she was stoked about it.
It was around the twisty stuff anyway, because I was out on stage taking photos for the event, and the thing was very quick, like, you know, braking, turning in, getting on the power early and everything. It was like right up there with the best tarmac cars around. So,
and they would be the efficiency of that, of how quick they can change direction. I remember we were in the Subaru and we'd have a ripper stage and we'd go, that was pretty good. And you look at the time and you're still 2 seconds behind Eli, and it's like, oh, God. And you go, I had an overshoot and I had to back up and go off here. I thought, really? Okay. It wasn't quite that bad.
Well, speaking of the Subaru, we've got to show one clip.
Yeah.
We were lucky enough that we were shooting the event photography, and we also had Sam from Racing Line Australia doing the video for us as well. And perks of being a co-driver sometimes. Getting up
to that. You're talking about that Subaru.
So many Subarus.
There's just so many Subarus going on. Like Andy, you lucky.
Tell the story.
You had, like, that was the photo that we posted on the Instagram. That was Andrew took that at the finish line of the event, where Andy's got this just monster grin on his face.
I was laughing at Colson because he's come up to take these photos of everybody finishing the thing and, like, come up and, like, that was cool. And then he's seen that I was driving and he's just like, you've just pissed yourself laughing. And I just laughed. And then you took a photo. But
we'll just quickly play that quick, because that's
and obviously it's untimed, and you basically had to finish. And I think at that point, we were second to John Ireland in the Viper, and we
going in and we're talking about, okay, well, you can wind some more clicks into the shocks and we'll wind the diff off and we'll do this and it'll go donuts. And Ben was just like, well, do you want to do it? And I was like, oh, okay, oh, I say no. So keeping in mind that in the back of my head, the last time this car was used at a rally to do, which was Rally Tasmania, they had a bit of a tarmac special demonstration. This car was used by someone who I'm not going to shame on the podcast. but he was attempting to do basically the same thing and it was just fighting him to the point that it fought into the point of a gutter and it got pole and may have bent the back wheel. So keeping that in the back of my head, I was like, yeah, I'll do donuts in your car and haven't driven it, but I'll have a go. And, yeah, that was the end result, which good success, I guess, and we finished. So that was good. Yeah. And someone got it on video, which doesn't happen very often.
Because you were telling me, yeah, and you didn't hit anything. Because I was going to say, you know, that was a real test of a real test of nerve there. Because you know, I would err on the side of, look, this is a very, very public way to demonstrate that I don't really know how to drive this car. So I'm just going to let's responsibly cross the line and have a beer and call it a day. And obviously you approach that slightly differently. And you were saying that you tried it on the first sort of 360 and it didn't really work. And then the second one.
As demonstrated in the video, I tried to flick it in the first one and it just basically did a four-wheel slide. And because it's the Subaru, it doesn't really have any torque. I'm used to the Evo, which is a bit different. And so the second one, I just do the same thing, rev the shit out of it and drop the post. So yeah. Meanwhile, Steve is in the passenger seat of Ben's car waiting at the start line, ringing me, and my phone's ringing in my leg pocket on the start line. And he's just sitting there giggling and going, oh, I'm just stuff this up.
Yeah. Well, I felt sorry for the guys who were in the tour group, like running through there, because again, I was there taking photos and doing the video and everything, and listening to the crowd's reaction, everyone coming through. So when you went through there, it was just like everyone went nuts because it was just good to see someone throwing some proper rings.
Because it's actually a very hard thing to do, because unless you've done it a bit and you know how the car's going to behave, a lot of the guys in some of the, you know, the more road-oriented cars, you try and tip them in to do that and they just plow understeer and just washes all the speed off, and then you end up kind of, you know, 5 meters from the apex and, you know, bit of hope of disappointment. And so to actually, I reckon there was probably only a handful, maybe five or six people who actually.
Yeah, Darren Masters, I think, did a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, he did pretty good.
There was a couple of good ones. But yeah, Darren did some proper helis. Yeah.
Who was in the Merc? Is that who's the winemaker? Jim. Was it Jim?
Jim Barry in the Pagoda.
Jim Barry. So he had a Pagoda, the white Pagoda. And I remember seeing him at the
loosest thing in the rally.
Yeah, it was great. I remember seeing him at scrutineering, and like this old Pagoda rocks up and Jim gets out and he's all
automatic.
Automatic. And I remember looking at it and it had fresh tires on it. I've gone, oh, wait, he's putting new tires on it. Supercats. okay, we'll see how this thing goes around. But when he got to that special stage and he like single tire fire city, it was just phenomenal. I got a great shot of it as well. Like phenomenal.
Your photo only shows the one wheel that was spinning, so it looks.
Yeah, it was. I was on the perfect side.
Yeah, the other side is
needs a new right hand rear supercat, but yeah, it was worth it.
Yeah. So no, that was
you'll be fun.
That was just a great event, and it's
that finish was really good. That concept of having it right in the middle of the city. Once again, there was a crowd there, and they need to do that again because it was fantastic to have it smack them.
We've been lucky enough to be involved with the event for a number of years with Tim doing the photography and some video for him as well. And, you know, given the fact that the motorsport festival stopped, I know that Andrew and I, we were both like really worried that the rally wouldn't be happening. And so when he said that it was actually happening and was going on board and everything, it was great. You know, we were so happy that the event went. And then, to have that finish, you know, was fantastic, you know, to have in town again, on top of Goodger Street as well, because Goodger Street's amazing every year to get involved with anyone. But actually having some competition, you know, there for people to actually see and finish there and everything was just great. And have the Stag Hotel again, you know, that was always a good way to end the night, having a beer at the Stag.
I think on a- on a wider spectrum, I think those events now, especially, you know, the Adelaide Rally now have done probably more to secure the future of rallying in Australia than just about, you know, a lot of people are working at this, but I think by introducing those more attainable classes, the challenge classes and the Spirit Tour classes where, you know, because I know certainly, you know, 10 years ago, if you wanted to go rallying, you needed a dedicated rally car and you needed to commit your life to it. And, you know, you couldn't have a car that you enjoy on the weekend and do two or three events a year. And like you needed to go all in. And now with these new classes, it really has lowered the bar to entry significantly. And I think we've already seen the number of people that start off competing in these speed limited classes and gradually sort of work their way up. And next thing you know, they're out competing in full comp and doing,
yeah, well, you know, serious. There's a progression to it. That's the biggest thing that, like, gravel is really lacking, and that's something that it's really hard to do now because of all the regulations. Everyone's going to have harness devices and all this sort of stuff.
Which is really hard.
We all need them, but it's really hard from a gravel point of view to go from having your $200 Gumtree special that you've done, you know, Carnacross type events in, and then go to step up to full stage rallying. And that's something that whoever can solve that, you know, problem and get some sort of progression through the middle, they'll do well, because it can't do the same thing that you do with tarmac where you have those tour packety type classes, because on gravel no one can see. So
you're not gonna have the Porsche Australia sponsoring the Porsche owners to take their cars around Cairo.
And I think I'd watch that.
We'd love to see a whole bunch of
But I think as well, I mean, the other barrier, I mean, I know that, you know, Southern Districts Car Club, there are ways you can get out. They have the, you know, the rookie rally, rally SA. So there are people trying to address this problem. But I think gravel has the additional problem that unless you have a dedicated car, it kind of does ruin the car.
And also the safety aspect of, like, I mean, tarmac as well, but gravel's just that little bit more.
Yeah, the corner speed's a lot slower in gravel, though.
I think gravel's safer. I'd argue gravel's safer.
Yeah, I actually think gravel's safer, personally. Tarmac, I mean, look at how many tour cars end up in various creeks or whatever every year. Gravel, I think, overall is a safer thing, and people don't have as big a confidence on gravel straight away as they might on tarmac, and that's probably one thing that the tarmac, you know, it sort of encourages people, like, hey, check this out, you can go really fast. But gravel, you're sort of like, well, hang on, I don't know what's going to happen here.
And cars these days, like, fast cars are cheap. You know, it's never been more attainable and easier to get yourself into a fast car. And the thing is unless you've worked up to that, when they let go in a very quick, very surprising manner. And if you're on a tarmac stage and you lose grip all of a sudden, like, that becomes a big problem. Whereas if you're gravel and you've got more time to wash off speed into a corner and slower it,
you're in a constant state of slide as well, almost on gravel. Like, you're always moving the car, whereas you're not often caught out by, oh, hang on, I've got no grip at all, because you don't have a lot to start with. So, tarmac, you go from, like you say, you go from being, oh, this is all sweet, to, oh, hang on, what's going on here?
So, but I think that rally is great, because, you know, if people take out their weekend cars and they can do some light competition in it and they get the bug, and I think it's fantastic. And I guess now when we're doing this podcast because we're all in our homes and we can't go and do that, it just, you know, that Adelaide rally, that sunset and having those beers and watching the rally cars come in, and it just seems so far away at the moment. It just seems like a distant memory of years ago. But
that was the last rally event I did, now I think about it. And it does feel like it feels like a long time ago.
Even though I was, you know, very lucky a couple of weeks ago, I was a bouncer in a vintage sports car club trial in a Vauxhall 3098, and it's great fun. Absolutely great fun. Like, it's fantastic. You know, you take these priceless old vintage cars and you try and drive them up muddy inclines, you know, and the value of these cars is crazy. And you know, our job, so we had the four of us, and our job is sitting in the back, and you bounce up and down to get the traction on the wheels to sort of skip it through the mud. And we stopped on one when the divots were so deep on this mud track that we beached the bottom of the car and the flywheel, because there's no cover on the bottom of the flywheel.
That's what I mean, Pete, because you've got quite a lot of
room.
There's like
you know, more than a Land Cruiser clearance.
A lot of ground clearance. Little skinny wheels. And this poor Vauxhall, we beached it in the middle of the mud track, and it was like clay. You could barely walk around, and we're covered in, and it's pissing with rain, and we're just having a great time, just covered in mud. And some of it was incredible. But yeah, we beached the flywheel into the mud, and it stalled the engine because the flywheel, there's no cover on the bottom of it. So the flywheel, you can see where it's sort of scraped the top surface of the mud, and then eventually it's gone and just jammed it. And then the cars just jam. You hit the starter motor, and the starter motor just doesn't even do anything because the mud is just jamming this engine up, and we had to tow it out with the Land Rover and that. But anyway, that was a bit of a sidetrack. But where I was going with that was the last event I went to, and at the time it was still going ahead, and it was a very small sort of out in the country type thing, only a handful of people and whatnot, and we did it. And even that 2-3 weeks ago now, Gillian Carr, who I was talking to, she was the one that kindly invited me along, and we were just saying it, just we had a pub dinner, and we just both worked out that was actually the last time that we'd gone out for dinner as well. It just seems like a memory of a long time ago. So
Being stuck inside really makes time go slow.
So I guess, Andy, at Autosport, how are you guys coping? What's been the impact?
It's a massive impact for us. We're obviously a business that relies on motorsport and motorsport events to basically continue with what we do. So yeah, we've certainly found it already even, and I feel like we're only just getting started with what's happening. Yeah. So we're definitely seen a big drop in turnover massively. Yeah.
So those people who don't know Autosport is
we're a motorsport equipment shop. It's been around for, 41 years, I think, this year, maybe 42. Started by a couple of brothers there was a shop in Adelaide and a shop in Melbourne. I'm obviously in the Adelaide shop, and that's the only one left now. But, we do all sorts of things, helmets, suits, everything, down to Weber Carbies, not barbecues. So, all sorts of different things. Absolutely. I haven't been asked for any Weber barbecues this week. I've been asked for everything else, but I got a guy ring up looking for a cricket bat yesterday. But
everyone out there is a bit bored at work at the moment with customers just ring up and stuff asking, what size Weber kettle you can get.
Screwdrivers and the like. So we've obviously been involved with club level rallies, circuit racing, up to, a couple of supercar guys. Todd Hazelwood, we've got a good affiliation with, and sort of always work with him, and everyone in between. We're all still there. We're still operating and come and buy some things.
Something I liked about Autosport, and I think Matt set you guys in good stead for the coming months of people being at home, but just having like a decent online store. It's really hard for like an Australian motorsport place store to have decent online store. And one thing I really liked was have the starter packs for people. Yeah. So if you did want to get into motorsport, you've bought an Excel or you've bought a sprint car or, something to go and do some track days out at your local circuit, they've got packages where it's cams approved, harness cams approved, stickers, helmet, race suit, boots, or, few and far between. There's a whole heap of levels there. It makes it easy for just the average punter who might be doing some work at home because they're stuck at home and they're still working, but they got some money to spend
now it's something we've all seen that I think right now people really need to. I mean, obviously everyone's watching their pennies. I know a lot of our listeners personally. I know of people that are losing their jobs and have lost their jobs, and it's a very tough time coming up. But I mean, if you do have a bit of spare cash and you are thinking of doing it, coffee shops, pizza places, Autosport, local businesses, really send it their way right now because these people, we're going to get through this and it's going to be fine and life's going to go back to normal, and we want all of these businesses to be there on the other side of this.
If you're local in Australia, buy from Autosport. If you're local, buy from Demon Tweaks. If you're in the UK and you're watching from the UK, buy from Demon Tweaks.
But if you've got time and you've been thinking about, plumbing in a new firebomb system, if you've been thinking about updating your belt, do it now. Like if you're going to do it at the end of the year, bring it forward, do it now.
Replace that leaky speed flow fitting.
Yes. Oh, look, it's, if you're going to buy something now, probably, to be honest, is the time to buy it, because not only are people watching their dollars, the dollar has gotten terrible. So a lot of the costs will, you know, we're trying to hold as much as we can, and you know, where we can, we'll try and keep the pricing where it is. But unfortunately, a lot of areas, you know, probably 80% of our stock comes from overseas, and, you know, all the when the dollar drops by 10 to 15%, so unfortunately, prices change. So, look, we're trying to hold that as best we can. And at the moment, we'd rather sell things than not. So, it's just more a case of turnover than anything. But yeah, like you say, that's I think for the next period to come. Yeah, that's certainly going to be something that, particularly in Australia, where we're at the bottom of the world, and it's quite hard to actually get stock even at the minute. We deal with a few companies in Italy, and they're off this week. They've been trading up until this point to some extent, but we can't even order today. Like, if I wanted to do an order today, I think they're back next week. But yeah, a lot of that stuff's really affected, and I think that will continue in not just our business, but I think a lot of different areas will be quite a tricky next period of time for everyone. Yeah. And yeah, like I said, if we all kind of try and look after each other as best we can, we'll hopefully get to the end of it. Oh well. We got through that. Let's go racing.
I'm convinced you're assuming we still have an economy left at the end of this, and assuming we have a society. I think that when we get the all clear to go racing again, and when we get the all clear to take cars out and start doing stuff, it's going to be one hell of an end to the year. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be insane. It's going
to
be awesome.
Everyone's got two holes to rub together. I hope, from an improved production point of view, we were set to have round one the weekend just gone, and we had our biggest field that we probably would have had for several years out, that at Malar, and unfortunately, obviously, that couldn't happen. But I hope that everyone, keeps their cars there and, does whatever they need to do, and we go out and knock over in October and have a race.
Well, if you're short of cash, probably a good thing to do is go and hit up maybe Kleenex or some other toilet paper brand for some sponsorship dollars after all that.
Yeah, mate, they don't need to sponsor anyone now. They don't need to sponsor anyone. They're just going, thank you.
I had to go to 6 stores the other day because we didn't panic right at the start. We were just kind of like, nah, we'll be fine. We don't use that much. And then 6 stores.
Everyone's looking at the preppers. Looking at the preppers. We've laughed at them for the last 10 to 15 years, and now we're going like, maybe they're onto something here.
I will make mention, though, hey, if you guys want to ask some questions, send them through on Instagram or put them on the chat. Andy, you're right to ask us some questions if people got anything about improved production or rallying or sport or anything like that.
Yeah, cool.
So, yeah, I'll just browse through those for the moment.
So we've got some questions, but it's just an odd time that we live in. We've all got a lot of time on our hands,
In Australia, we've gone from being on fire, and now even from a motorsport point of view, like for me, obviously missed Rally Australia last year because of the cancellations with bushfires everywhere.
Yeah.
The first test day that I was supposed to do with Luke this year was still cancelled because of the bushfires. The second one was cancelled because it was raining so hard it was underwater. And then now obviously we've got a virus and no one can go to anything. So it's just crazy. Like you almost forget what motorsport was like at some point.
Yeah, I'm definitely struggling with it. It's hard. I mean, the Goodwood live stream was pretty good the other day though. I was cleaning up in my shed. And trying to get ready for the podcast again in here after doing some gyp rocking on the ceiling and everything, and had it up on the projector while I was working. And it was just great to see something on and some motorsport. I think everyone's kind of really pushing that throwback memories stuff.
I had the 1986 Adelaide Grand Prix, I think, F1 shared this morning, which was cool. Like 20 minutes of that before I went to work. That was a cool thing.
That's cool. I think it's gonna make us appreciate a lot, because I know I'm in the UK, I'm very lucky to go to all the Goodwood events. I was supposed to be a members meeting last weekend.
Dream, really.
Yeah, it's been great. But this is gonna make me sound terrible, but 3 Goodwood events a year plus the other stuff they do, I'm down there 4, 5, 6 times a year. And it does start to, once you've, I feel terrible saying this, but once you've been to 2 or 3 Festival of Speeds, you do get used to them somewhat. And now I really am kicking myself. I think we're going to appreciate everything a lot more, like the simple act of going down and getting a coffee in town, you know, going to these amazing events, you know, that being able to go racing. Like, I think a lot of things that people take for granted across the board, I hope, at least anyway, we're all going to just really appreciate what we've got a little bit more than, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I went to Super Sprint the other weekend just because it was an event on, you know, like they cancelled the race meeting. I was like, oh, hang on, get on the internet. What can I do that's on before, you know, everything shut down? And yeah, there was 100 people at this sprint. It was crazy. Everyone was basically doing a similar thing. Like, oh, let's do some motorsport before we're on the shed for. So
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, we've got some questions here from some Instagram listeners out there. Sanjay's got one. Yeah, cool. So Sanjay, we featured in issue 1 of Sportscast Safari magazine in his Pagoda. Did a pretty cool trip. He ended up doing an Adelaide rally, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I have a copy here. I'll find the story.
Let me just bring you up. Hang on.
No, issue 2. Issue 2.
Andrew's story, yeah, it was fantastic. So, well, hang on. Sorry, guys, we're getting a bit of a rolling stream update there. Hang on, it's just jumping around. Yeah, we're like 2 seconds while we work out this technical glitch at the moment, which is Andrew, just hang on. The browser's just decided to switch between cameras nonstop. So,
oh, great. Fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic.
Well, as long as the audio is good, you can all just shut your eyes for a little while.
Not noticed. It's a bit strobe lighty at the moment. Hang on.
You might have got a flash of that pagoda.
Yeah, maybe. Hang on. I'll just try and...
The technical issues.
Yeah. This is a new bit of streaming software. It's browser-based, so obviously susceptible to issues like everybody else. So...
But the proper software that everyone uses is very, actually very expensive. So
Here we are.
Well, let's get going on the question anyway. And if our audio is good, I'm sure Andy can answer it, and everyone can just look away from the screen for a minute until Luke fixes it. So what was the question?
So hang on. We'll try and do a couple of things at once. Hang on.
There you go. You fixed it.
Nope.
Nearly. Nope.
Hang on. Yeah. Okay. Good. I think. Oh no. Oh crap. This is gonna look hilarious. I can't wait.
We run a very tight ship here. Make no update, no judgment.
That's good. Hang on. Wish there was a way with this software you could like just pause what the world's going on, but might be able to get it from the other one. If you just bear with me for 2 seconds, actually, Sanjay, I'll give you Sanjay's question. Will we see IPRA, Improved Production Racing Australia, back as a support category anytime soon?
Excellent question. If you all ring up the Adelaide 500 people and tell them that you would like IP back, that would help. we've certainly been trying. Obviously, the last couple of years, we haven't made the gig. There's a fair bit of other influence, I think, with that event as to what's put on and what's not. I think I was a bit disappointed, to be honest, going this year. I don't know. Did you go, Luke? Did you end up going to?
I actually didn't this year.
No.
No, that's the first time I haven't gone in a while. So
to be honest, it was almost disappointing going this year. Just the crowd numbers and you compare it to, well, even a good example, you look at the crowd that was at the Grand Prix that was on that stream this morning from the 80s and it's huge. And, you know, I think unfortunately the event at the moment's gone away from being a motorsport event. They're almost trying to run it like a fringe festival and just need to get back to the fact that it's a race event and people go there for racing, not for off-track things. And, you know, one race an hour isn't really cutting it at that level. So... Look, we'd love to be back there, and I think certainly the category deserves a spot, but I'm biased. So, I don't really know what the solution is to trying to get a spot back. But
I just think from a marketing point of view, the reach, the social media reach that your improved production race has got internationally, seeing it from an international perspective, was far wider than any other category at that event has ever managed, I think ever. You know, when you've got Jalopnik, who you have literally millions and millions of website hits writing about these videos and sharing them, and they're mentioning Adelaide, and people are seeing the track and they're watching this video with the city in the background of the parklands, like that, if you're looking at it, you know, from a tourism board perspective of just an investment of, you know, money in, money out, you know, whatever, that's got to be... We still going?
Sorry, just had a little bit of an outage there.
Are we still streaming?
Yeah, we still got this issue though of rolling through cameras.
Okay.
So
well, good that we're back. maybe we never left. But yeah, no, I think.
Yeah, look, no disagreement at all from that aspect. Yeah. I think unfortunately that may have almost been our downfall in some aspects, because it stole a limelight from other things. But yeah, I can't see why we're not there. It certainly is excellent racing.
Yeah. Luke, how are we doing? Do we have another question, or are we still
hang on, I think I've just fixed it.
Well done.
I just need to sort my camera out again. So give me 2 seconds. Yes, there were some more questions.
Why don't we one more question, Luke, before you sort the camera? One more question.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm just bringing it up. Trying to do four things at once. That was a good one. Gordon.
Oh, no.
Love Gordon. Gords 57, if you want some lovely Volvo porn on Instagram at Gords57. He asked, do you like meerkats? That's the first question.
Who doesn't?
They are.
Next question, more serious note.
Meerkats. I was going to say, you know, if we're talking shout out to Gords, you know, Adelaide Rally, I was photographing at the jump on Mount Lofty Summit, and there's a photo circulating. I think it was in our Instagram post of Andy, you know, in the WRX flying over. Gord's centered over that jump in a road car with no cage. He got more air than probably 95% of the competition cars in that field.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And it didn't land particularly well. There was a bit of a bounce.
We didn't have Raga. We had Raga, so it was fun.
But
yeah, not marked, absolutely. Not
marked for the send. Anyway, yeah, just had
he asked, as a navvy, do you build trust in your driver from watching them and knowing their credibility, or through actual personal seat time?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you've still got to vet some people, I guess. You know, you wouldn't go get in the car with someone who's crazy. I wouldn't personally, but you'd be surprised how much you can control of the pace of the car from reading notes. Andrew, you'd be able to attest to that. You know, particularly with new guys, the biggest thing seems to be that they just, to go faster, you drive harder, and that's not the way you do it. It's a good way to drive off the edge of the road. So in a lot of cases with the couple of newer guys that I've been with, you've almost had to tell them to slow down, but they go faster. So I guess it's something you build up over an event, but yeah, you've still got to, I guess, have a little bit of a look at who you're getting in with to start with.
Yeah,
absolutely. He's actually got another really good one too that I thought was quite good. Was what was your favourite Targa?
Oh, Targa Taz has to be. That's the thing. That said, Lofty is pretty cool. It doesn't matter what car. Yeah, it's just a great stage.
So Lofty's a stretch of road up in the Adelaide Hills where we all grew up, and probably as young peak players and sometimes older drivers too, there's been some really good midnight punts through there at 10 tenths.
Well, I think
to do that in closed road is probably, I guess, one of the greatest things
I think can do. The year me and Mike Busby did it in my Sprinter, I've never driven that bit of road that wet. There was a metre wide river down each side of the road. And we were fastest classic car up there, and I think we were, you know, 10 seconds or 8 seconds off passing him in his GDR at the time, and it was so we're in the Corolla with like 80s suspension, and we had a ball, but it got to the end, and I was like, okay, we can go home now.
Because I think Buzz has had similar comments about doing lofties. Yeah. Like, we'll leave those stories to another day. But
that's a good story.
I think Felix, our friend Felix, if you're listening, Felix made the point that if you actually looked at the result sheet of Adelaide Rally this year and checked off how many like Hills Bandits grew up meeting there on Saturday nights late and have actually progressed into doing it legitimately in events, which is great.
It's funny that stage because there's people that are sort of would jump 5 or 10 spots outright on that stage. Just from knowledge and going full send
on that particular road.
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of Busby, he actually had an interesting question, and I'll show it to you, and then I'll show it to everyone. He goes, "Can you ask if he could recognize this at over 100 kilometers an hour?" Looking briefly, I'll hold it up to the camera because I don't want to go on it.
So that's a guinea fowl. The story of this is we did Rally SA, I don't even remember, maybe 2013, and we were doing the honeysuckle stage, and we've come up over a brow, and it's third gear, fourth gear or something, and it's like slid over the brow, nice line, right at the apex, and one of those things is standing on the apex and got vaporized. And I sort of looked up, oh, guinea fowl, and then kept reading notes. And he's wiped out, and we've continued, and nothing's said. And he gets to the end, and he goes, "How did you see that or know what that was?" Yeah, it was a guinea fowl.
No, it's been great. Great to chat and hear the stories. I think motor racing generates these experiences and these stories, but I think rally even more so generates these. You go away from home with a group of people, hopefully they're your mates, and you're all away from home and you're all out on the road and some of the I know we've all certainly had there's some good stories there. That the parachutist down in Millicent was a good one for those listening, but it's not my place to tell that story. I think that's driving fast down roads is great fun, but I think it's everything else that comes with it is part of it.
Basically like going away for a whole day for a week and you sort of do some driving, but you get to go away with your mates.
Yeah,
you're exactly right. It's the experience outside of the stages sometimes that makes the event.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I was supposed to be in New Zealand today doing a target.
Great. One question. A few friends of mine and ours seems to be a big Australian, South Australian contingent that was going over. This is the Otago Rally in New Zealand, which is one of the all-time great classics. The roads over there are just flowing, cresty, smooth gravel. It's like a once-in-a-lifetime sort of bucket list. Where are their cars now? Are they in New Zealand? Are they halfway? Are they back? Or are they?
As far as I know, they didn't leave. They got really close, but I don't think they left. But I don't know. They might be there.
I think
the plan though was to leave them there and do some more events later in the year. I think there was a container with 3 or 4 SA cars in it.
Yeah,
I don't know if it left.
Okay, lucky. Yeah.
If it did, it's a good excuse to go over there and do some events. the roads are just.
Have you done anything in New Zealand before?
I did Otago last year. Sorry, one of the Zealand fellas.
Yep.
BMW E36 compact, I think it is.
Yep.
And unfortunately, it had an engine failure on the second stage.
Oh, no.
1.5 stages we did were amazing, and the rally was good. So, I'd certainly like to go back.
Fantastic. Well, guys, I think we've that's a show, isn't it? So anything else anyone wants to add? I think it's been a great chat. Thank you, Andy, for coming down.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. And I think auto sport is, you know, not intentionally just building this up, but I mean, one thing that I've amazed is in terms of like when everything's good, the time you spend in customer service versus products sold and dollars taken in, the ratio must be so far whack. You know, people would come in and talk to you for like an hour and then spend $300 on a helmet or something. You know,
depends on some head part of it. No, look, we're always there, and that's the thing we're there for. That's the difference between us and an online store, is that you can come in and see myself or see Simon, and you know, hopefully our expertise will help you make a decision on something or fit into something properly. I guess that's the biggest thing the internet doesn't do is, you know, you can measure your head. Head's a good example. You can measure your head all you want, but some people have oval heads, some people have round heads. Certain helmets will fit those better than others. So, you know, that's something you can't measure and can't really tell. So, yeah, there's definitely some, you know, other aspects to it that I think that the bricks and mortar shop can provide that an internet site can't. And I guess, you know, I think people understand that. And you know, we may not always be the cheapest, but we try to be. But I think certainly the advice is something that you can't pay for, and you know, we try and offer that where we can.
And I've always, you know, luckily I was, you know, when we were back in Adelaide, I lived around the corner, and I sort of was great to pop in and say hi. It was just a good sort of drop-in spot. So it'd be good to see that continue. That continue. So
we just have to stand a meter and a half away from each other, man. We had other lines on the floor, but yeah, we did do some on the floor today, just so it looks like we're sort of making effort. But you know, I think we're not that, you know, flush for a lineup of customers out the door. We're not Centrelink at this point, so I think everyone other than them is probably in a similar situation. But we're doing what we can do to comply, and while they let us be open, we'll be open.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So I guess we need to finish off with, if you want to learn more, at andy.san on Instagram.
Yep, I think so.
And _ Andy San at Autosport on Instagram. You guys on Instagram?
At Autosport Adelaide.
Yep. Autosport Adelaide. Luke is at Boxer33, BOXR33. I am at AGR_Andrew and at Sportscar Safari. So lots to follow there. And thank you, everyone. Thanks for your time.
No worries.